Beck and I went on, got back from India, hit the ground for a few days here, then we went on vacation, something we'd planned on for a while. It's always interesting when you go away and see different cultures, from poverty to a lavish lifestyle of people vacating. But for some reason, people that go on vacation decide to buy weird t-shirts. You ever notice that? That you go a place, and because you're no longer in Kansas or wherever you go to another place, that everybody decides they want to buy the t-shirt from that place. And, you know, then there's, you know, because it's from a certain place, they buy the t-shirt that still says, "I'm with stupid," right? And then the guy's t-shirt says, "I'm stupid," and it's spelled S-T-U-P-E-D, which is pretty cool. And if you didn't get it, stupid's with an I, just so you know, okay? One of my favorites that I saw this last trip was, "I'm here," exclamation point, "you still have two more wishes." You know, a genie in a bottle, you rub and you get three wishes, right? And so somebody's t-shirt said that. I didn't buy it, but I just saw it and laughed and chuckled. And it was really funny because it was an old man with a big, healthy, looked like he had a healthy appetite. But it was pretty funny, pretty funny. I think about that and I think, don't say this out loud, please. But think about if you had three wishes. What would you wish for? Now think about that for a moment. Again, don't say it out loud, because I don't want anything to go south here. One of those wishes, though, I think would probably have something to do with money. That's just a guess. One of those wishes might have something to do with world peace or cure for cancer, you know, something benevolent to the world, you know. But think about it in the spiritual terms of how many times do we wish that God were different, or we could grasp God or understand Him in a better way. Luke writes to the church, to people who love God, and he's trying to explain to them why we should have a firm faith. He's trying to encourage them in their relationship with the Lord to strengthen their faith and know why and have a firm affirmation of why we believe what we believe. As we've been going through this, we come on the heels of where we get ready to begin our story. And so if you want to go ahead and turn there to the Gospel of Luke chapter 20, we're going to be in there today. But it's right after Jesus has just come into Jerusalem, and they call it the triumphal entry. Now, Jesus had some pretty good days when he's resurrected people from the dead like Lazarus. He's healed people like lepers, or caused someone to walk, or he's walked on water. And so those are pretty fantastical things from a ministry point of view, but from a pure enjoyment, or a time when Jesus was acknowledged by people, this was probably his very best day. He comes riding into town on a donkey, as prophesied by one of the Old Testament prophets. They cut branches from trees, the palm branches. We know this in Easter time as Palm Sunday. He comes riding down, and it's basically like a ticker tape parade. It's as if he won the Super Bowl or the World Series, like he was just inaugurated as the King of Kings. And they're all praising him and hailing him and shouting to him. And it's so appropriate. Not that Jesus is egotistical, because he doesn't need that, but there's a right order of that. And it's almost as if we get to this part of the story and we're like, wow, that's the right way. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And there's just a good feeling about that. That if all days on Jesus' earthly life, the scripture reminds us that he was well acquainted with grief and sorrow. He didn't get much joy. He just worked hard. He suffered. And people didn't get him, and people didn't understand him. But this was the day. This was a moment in his life where people acknowledged him and got it right, just for a moment. But right after that, he comes in, and it's not like he relishes in it very long. The next text reminds us that he cleans out the temple. I told you last week that as I was in India, there's this long, long corridor, about 300 yards of corridor, and it's all these merchants selling stuff to go sacrifice to their different gods. wasn't very different in Jesus' day. All the merchants would get there, and still, in those days of sacrifice and offering and praise, you would burn incense to the Lord, you would buy some turtle doves, you would buy some pigeons, maybe you would buy, if you were wealthy, you would buy a goat to go offer your sin offerings. You present things to the priest to say, I'm here, I don't come empty-handed, I'm bringing my offering. Sometimes it would be the tithe, sometimes it would be a drink offering, sometimes it would be a grain offering. So, but all these people are bringing this different stuff, and now they're in the temple courts, and they've turned worship into this market thing. It's about raising money and getting money off of the sacrifices. And so Jesus is mad, and he comes through, and he doesn't relish in everybody celebrating him, but immediately he goes to work, and it's as if he wants to pick a fight. And he goes in and he cleans out the temple in a very aggressive way. It's one of those almost like an anomaly of Jesus, that we think of Jesus soft and benevolent and warm, but he comes in, and some of the texts remind us that he has a whip, and he drives people out, and he overturns the table, and he scatters, lets the animals free, and all this stuff, and it's just some chaos and chaos. And then people want to know what's going on. And so we pick up the story in Luke chapter 20, verse 1. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the good news. So in the midst of this, he's still preaching. He's proclaiming the good news that there's hope, that there's life, that more than just the religiosity of it all. And proclaiming the good news, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, came to him. Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things, they said. Who gave you this authority? Really, Jesus is just an itinerant preacher to them. They don't recognize him as the Messiah. They don't recognize it as his Father's house. And so it'd just be like, as I told you last week, imagine me going into India, to a different country, and all of a sudden just turning all of the stuff over and just causing havoc, and they would arrest me. But somehow Jesus escapes them because they want to arrest him, but what's just happened? He's a hero. He just had a ticker tape parade, and they're worried about causing this riot because everybody is in love with Jesus because he's been healing people, he's been forgiving people, he's been gracious, he's done nothing wrong except for now he gets mad about the temple, and now they want to know, well, who gave you this authority? Where do you come from being able to do this and just come in and disrupt our temple worship? So Jesus replied, verse 3, I will also ask you a question. Tell me, John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? The narrator says, they discussed it among themselves and said, if we say from heaven, he will ask, why didn't you believe him? Knowing that obviously they didn't believe him. But if we say of human origin, all the people will stone us because they are persuaded that John was a prophet. So they answered, we don't know where it was from. And Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things. This is question, counter question. This is, if it was you're watching a tennis match, volley, and Jesus volleys back, and nothing happens. There's no return. He went on, verse 9, he went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. He sent another servant, but that one also, they also beat and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. He sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. Then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. What then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. When the people heard this, they said, God forbid. They're like aghast at this incredulous story. Jesus looked directly at them and asked, then what is the meaning of that which is written, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces. Anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. The teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. But they were afraid of the people. The parable of the tenants, Jesus is really highlighting the fact that why, what authority are you doing these things? I'm the heir. Who's the owner of the vineyard? God. Who are the tenants? The Pharisees and the teachers of the law that are supposed to be teaching people about God, about how to have a relationship with Him, not just religiosity and religious practices. Who were the servants sent? The prophets over and over saying, you got to get in line. God doesn't desire mercy. He desires doesn't desire sacrifice. He desires mercy. He wants your hearts to be rendered. Worship me in spirit and truth. All those things the prophets do. And what do the prophets? They stone them. They killed them. They beat them. They sent them away. No one listened to them. Who is the son in the story? Jesus is prophesying and depicting the kind of death he's about to die. He is the heir. God finally said, they don't listen to my prophets. I'm going to send my one and only son. And what happens to that son? You and I know the end of the story. We know that they also killed him. And what is going to happen to the tenants? Well, they'll get theirs. The Pharisee sect doesn't exist today, nor does the Sadducee sect. God was done with that, and he handed it over. There's different groups today, still in Judaism, but not those groups. He says this amazing phrase, the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. He's quoting David from Psalm 118, talking about this prophetic idea that there's this cornerstone. We talk about Jesus being the cornerstone. It's the firm, the solid, the true, the real, the rock of Gibraltar, all those euphemistic things that we say about him, and they reject him. But he highlights the fact that you have two options in this life. One falls on the stone and broken to pieces. Or the stone falls on you and you are crushed. Which do you choose? I hate that. I don't like brokenness. If this were a game show, it'd be like, I'd like, you know, pain and suffering for $500, Bill. You know, brokenness for $300, Bill. I'll try, take my spin at the wheel, you know. Oh, great, I get crushed. Hallelujah. Those are good times. Everybody wants to be a Christian, right? Nobody comes to salvation in strength. No one comes to God in confidence. No one comes to a holy God proud or great intelligence or with it all together. This is Jesus letting them know, not only is he picking a fight and he's disrupting their concept of what it means to be a religious person, but he's really telling them that you've got to really change at your core, and this is going to crush you if you think it's going to be any different. Because, see, everybody thought, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hallelujah. The Savior has rode into town. See you, Romans. And Jesus goes, I got a different way. And it's not any way that you suspect or you can imagine or you can begin to fathom. And I've come to bring good news, but not good news as you suppose. So they try questioning his authority. They get upset that he's calling them to account and that he's highlighting them in parabolic fashion that they're kind of dirt weasels. But they still can't do anything about it because they know the crowd. So now they try a political angle. Look at verse 20. Keeping a close watch on him, they sent spies who pretended to be sincere. They hoped to catch Jesus in something he said so that they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor. They can't figure out in a religious way how to trip him up theologically, so they go, we know, we'll catch him in a legal loophole. We'll catch him in a way that the government will clamp down on him and he will offend the authorities. So, this verse 21, so the spies questioned him. Teacher, we know that you speak and teach what is right and that you do not show partiality, but teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Man, they're piling on thick, aren't they? Is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Well, that's a great church question, isn't it? Should we honor the government? Should we all pay taxes? Everybody has different theological stances on that. And so they asked Jesus the same thing, knowing that Jesus is proclaiming that he's the King of God, or the King of all the earth. Verse 23, he saw through their duplicity and said to them, now I love that. They pretended to be sincere, but Jesus saw through their duplicity. I love that he did that. And by the way, I hate that he does that to me. Don't you? Not to me, but yourself. He says, show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription on it? Caesar's, they replied. He said to them, then give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. They were unable to trap him in what he had said there in public, and were astonished by his answer, and they became silent. Another volley, whack, and Jesus smashes it with a backhand. And there's no return. No political coup. So, verse 27. Some of the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to Jesus with a question. So there's groups. The Pharisees believe in the resurrection. They're the keepers of the law. The Sadducees are an aristocratic sect, but they believe that you just live for this life and do good, and there is no afterlife. That you get your reward here. So some of the Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to Jesus with the question, teacher, they said, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, the man must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Note what's going on in the Mosaic law. Think about it. That if someone's spouse dies, like her, so your brother, say, my brother passes away, then I would have to go marry my sister-in-law. And some of you would have to do the same. Okay? Okay, that's kind of what's going on. So this is the Mosaic law. And the reason, the idea behind the Mosaic law was so that she wouldn't be widowed, she'd be taken care of and be a part of that family, part of the lineage stuff of it, okay? So this is the Mosaic law. It also is about Judaism and keeping the Jewish pedigree pure. Verse 29. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married a woman and died childless. The second one, and then the third married her. And in the same way, the seven died, leaving no children. Finally, the woman died too. Now then, at their resurrection, whose wife will she be since the seven were married to her? See, this is part of the reason that the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. They're going, how does this all get worked out? This is kind of crazy. What do we do with the Jewish law? What do we do with the Mosaic law? Whose husband will she be? It's a legitimate question that they think they got Jesus trapped. Jesus replied, the people of this age marry and are given to marriage, but those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage. And they can no longer die, for they are like the angels. They are God's children since they are children of the resurrection. Let me read that one more time. Just so we're clear. Debbie's mother passed away and went to be with the Lord. Many of you heard about Elda Jean Marie, Pastor Muller's wife, was here 2 months ago. Got home from being here, passed away. Now there's 200 orphans or 200 kids that she feeds every day and 40 orphans that don't have a mom, and that was the only mom they had. Vicki lost her brother. Jeff lost a sister and a daughter. Marja lost a dad. We've had a lot of death. People have all kinds of questions, don't we? Remember these words. But those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage, and they can no longer die, for they are like angels. They are God's children, since they are children of the resurrection. That is our hope. When all else boils down to questions about life and eternity, there is our hope. No wonder Jesus has been preaching the good news. He says, but in the account of the burning bush, even Moses showed that the dead rise, for he calls the Lord of God, or the Lord, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living, for to him all are alive. Our dearly beloved who have passed, we mourn because we'll miss them, but they are alive. He's the God of Abraham, Jacob, Isaac, and Jana. Very much alive. That's what we believe, isn't it? Isn't that why we gather to worship, to go, there's more to life than this? Some of the teachers of the law responded, well said, teacher. So the Pharisees who believe in the right are going, right on, yeah. Take that, Sadducees. And no one dared to ask him any more questions. So here it is. Now the Sadducees try, everybody's trying these angles, and Luke records and puts these stories together. Why? Because Jesus has just come in a triumphant way, but Jesus is not done because he's not here. Imagine if everything about Jesus was just bottled up in Jerusalem. That Jesus had a bigger thing in mind of just appeasing the city of Jerusalem and everybody celebrating that he had come to town and now he's going to start a coup and rule over Jerusalem. Jesus had something way bigger in mind than just bottling it up. And that's why Romans 9, 10, and 11 remind us that we get to be grafted in because the Jews rejected him. See, Jesus has a bigger picture, and you and I can be here as Gentiles today worshiping because of the Jews' rejection. We get, you know, it's like, I always like it to a kid who doesn't want dinner and is real picky. I don't like that. What's pizza? It's your favorite. I don't like any but pepper. It's pepperoni pizza. It's your favorite. Well, I'm not hungry. And so you call the neighbor boy in. Hey, would you like my son's pizza? Yeah. It's pepperoni. Come on. And what happens when he starts eating the pepperoni and the son's watching him? I want some too. That's God's plan. The Jews rejected it, and God goes, well, okay, Gentile orphans, anybody want any food? And they go, yeah, it's life. And the Jews get a little jealous and go, we would like some too. And that's the hope. Because Jesus had a bigger plan than containing this thing, the good news in Jerusalem. And at every angle, someone lobs a question, political, theological, all these different ways, and they forget. We forget that Jesus is the smartest ever. You know, he's with stupid. Guess who stupid is? He's with us, right? Sorry. Sorry, people. You know, I'm an equal opportunity person. All of us are stupid. All of us are sinners. Okay, get over yourself. Compared to Jesus, he's pretty smart, right? You may be pretty intellectual. I'm happy for you. Good job. But Jesus is pretty cool. And he's pretty smart. And he's letting them know that at every angle, he can handle any of the questions of the age. Whatever is going on. We live in an age where our generation thinks we're pretty smart. And Jesus is pretty archaic. And he's not so hip. And he doesn't know all the answers. He's not scientific and all those things. And we forget how smart he really is. He handles every question with precision in a way that they're just dumbfounded. These are not idiots. These are the upper echelon of people in their day. We have a historical arrogance to think that we're the smartest generations that ever lived. And we're arrogant to think that people weren't brilliant back then. Look up Leonardo da Vinci sometime and see how you compare. Just throwing that out. Okay? So everybody's balling these questions and Jesus is wiping them out. He's return and serve and they can't handle them. Now listen what he says. Verse 41, then Jesus said to them, why is it said that the Messiah is the son of David? David himself declares in the book of Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. David calls him Lord. How then can he be his son? Because everybody knows that the Messiah is supposed to become from the loins of David. He's supposed to be the son of King David. And so Jesus just throws out a little theological question. So if he's supposed to come from King David, how does David years before go, he's my Lord, if he's my son? That's kind of what's going on. And Jesus stirs one up and they cannot return it. And he knows it. It's unanswerable. Unless you and I get it. Don't you? You and I get it. We believe that Jesus is in the lineage of David, but he was before him before all time. We believe that he made the heavens and the earth, and yet he came born of a virgin through the lineage of David. If you get it, then you're one of the few. And they don't get it then. Good job. You're not that stupid. Jesus turns to ask the tough question. And everyone's cheering Jesus on. Why? Because when he comes to town, people love winners. Don't you? I'm a KU fan. Sorry for those of you who are not. Maybe because when I was little, they were okay. But as I got older, they got really good. And they've had a pretty good program. But I can't stand it when they start to lose. I turn it off. Them big losers. They're the only second most winning program in all of history of basketball. And I get so upset when they start losing. Heaven forbid. We like clever. We like successful. And Jesus comes in and he recognizes that people like clever, they like successful, they like brilliant. But there's a problem that's going to happen and Jesus predicts it. I'm going to die. I'm going to lose, and I'm going to lose big, in fact. I'm going to lose my life. I'm going to lose this whole thing. So what can these texts and scriptures teach us, those of us who like winners? One, Jesus knows all the answers. He's pretty smart. Two, sometimes he just won't tell us. John's baptism, where does it come from? You may have questions, and sometimes he's just going to go, you don't need to know, I'm not telling you. Sometimes his answers will surprise you. You ever got a surprise answer from Jesus? Or is it just always that Jesus tells you whatever you want to hear? Because that's what happens with this generation. When Jesus rubs us a little bit along the wrong way, we're out. I only want him when he's in the good stuff. And the churches that are really big and powerful and growing are hearing just really positive stuff, just so you know. We won't grow anytime soon, I'm pretty sure. And sometimes he says, you don't really want to hear, do you? Everyone wants answers, don't we? We want solutions. We want resolve. We want closure. We want it to all be wrapped up nice and neat. We want it to somehow make sense. We want Jesus to tie it up, and we want him to be a genie in the bottle. And anytime we pray, we're rubbing the bottle and say, please give me what I want. Fix our lives, solve our issues, answer our questions. Someone said we can either use Jesus to help with our problems, or use our problems to help us find Jesus. The options for us today are crushed and broken. How do you like that, church? So to option number one, you live your life, and when you encounter Jesus, you realize that you have been wrong, and you're broken, and apart from him, and you have not been following his ways, and your life will just leak. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 13. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. When Jesus doesn't come through, we find our own way and we go, I'm going to find something that's really more refreshing. But the prophet tells us that we are like cisterns, that we dig our own wells, and it just leaks out of us. Life just happens, and stuff just leaks out of us, and no wonder we're always craving. No wonder we can never get drunk enough, high enough, stoned enough, exhilarated enough, excited enough, comforted enough, have enough food, have enough pleasure, have enough joy. It just leaks out of us. Or you live your life when you encounter Jesus and you try to discredit when he comes along. You try to invalidate. You try to disqualify him by being the Lord of our existence. We clever our way. I've got a way more logical way. We science our way. I did that for years. We cynic our way. I still do that sometimes. And we think we're smart. And we think God is kind of old, archaic, and old-fashioned, and I'm new, and I'm modern, and I got it going on. And then one day when life happens, we have to cry out to God. Because death comes knocking. And loss happens. And brokenness runs rampant in families. And usually people don't turn to science in that moment. They don't care much about logic. If they could rub a genie bottle and have something magical happen, we'd do it in a heartbeat. But life happens. But the problem is what Isaiah chapter 50, verse 10 and 11 says. Who among you fears the Lord and obeys the word of his servant? Let the one who walks in the dark, who has no light, trust in the name of the Lord and rely on their God. God is asking us to be people of faith and walk in the dark. What happens when we don't? But now, all of you who light fires and provide yourselves with flaming torches, go walk in the light of your fires and the torches you have set ablaze. This is what you receive. This is what you shall receive from my hand. You will lie down in torment. This generation, this world, us, the people of America, we like to pull out our flashlights when it's dark. No one wants to walk in the dark. It's scary. And we got to trust in that which we cannot see and that which we hope like crazy is real. But what happens is, I just can't do it, so I'm going to whip out my flashlight, my intellectual flashlight, and I'm going to see my way through, and at the end, maybe God will forgive me because he's benevolent. There's four questions that I want to leave us with today, real briefly. The questions that we ask God. God, will you help? I think this is God's answer. Not as you would like. You can't talk your way out of problems you have behaved yourself into. Hear that? Someone wrote, you cannot talk your way out of problems you behave yourself into. God asks us with a volley, will you try? Will you try to follow? Will you seek me more than you just seek relief? Sometimes we say to God, God, do you care? And he'll say, not as you suppose. I care about what is truly you and your heart. Do you care about your heart? Do you care about your inside? Do you care about your character more than your reputation? Sometimes we get deeper and say, well, God, will you heal? Not always as you want. All healing is temporary, even Lazarus died again. But God has a much bigger picture of healing. I'm always most interested in the bigger picture, he says, an eternal perspective. His question is, will you trust whether I heal or not? Okay, God, will you reveal yourself to me? And I think he'd say yes, but not in a way you can control. And the allegorical story of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lucy is human girl, woman, and she comes to Aslan the lion, and she meets him for the very first time, and it's a depiction of Jesus as the Lion of the tribe of Judah, but he's literally a lion. And so obviously you walk up to a giant lion, you know, and he's kind of scary. And so she approaches him cautiously, and she says, are you good? And he says, I'm good. But I'm not safe. We want a good and safe God. And Jesus says, I crush and I break and I'm not safe. And if you want a safe life, don't be a Christian. Don't. There's nothing safe about it. as scary as, you know what? It's scary. Because he requires of us something greater than ourselves, something to live for bigger than us. And you have to walk with this lion who's scary and unpredictable. And so he would volley, will you be humble? Will you trust? Will you watch over your heart? Will you try? And will you be humble enough to go against the fabric of this world, the grain of the society that says, I will trust you no matter what. I will follow you to the end, even when it looks like you're losing. And right after these stories of Jesus outsmarting everybody, at that moment, he got silent. He said, I'm not saying anything else. Why? So that you and I would have access, so that you and I would have the opportunity to be grafted in, because he saw the big picture. I will reveal myself to you quietly. Not as a magician, not as a genie, but as one who wants authentic, genuine relationship with you. Steve and I don't talk. Jody and I don't talk about the service, about the songs. I Still Believe by Jeremy Camp. You know how that happened, Jeremy Camp? He wrote this song, I Still Believe, and we sang it today, but he wrote it, he got engaged to a 21-year-old girl who had ovarian cancer. 5 months after they were wed, she died, and her request was, keep singing, keep trusting, keep believing, keep having hope. And so Jeremy Camp wrote this, and his 21-year-old wife died. Scattered words and empty thoughts seem to pour out from my heart. I've never felt so torn before, seems I don't know where to start. But it's now that I feel your grace fall like rain, from every fingertip washing away my pain. I still believe in your faithfulness. I still believe in your truth. I still believe in your holy word, even when I don't see. I still believe. Though the questions still fog up my mind with promises I still seem to bear, even when answers slowly unwind, it's my heart I see you prepared. But it's now that I feel your grace fall like rain, from every fingertip washing away my pain. The only place I can go is into your arms, where I throw to you my feeble prayers. In brokenness, I can see that this is your will for me. Help me to know you are near. Let's stand and pray. I have questions. You have questions. We all got questions. God has the answers. And sometimes he's just not going to tell us. But what he does offer is himself. Draw near to me, and I will draw near to you. I believe that when you're broken, he will search you out. When you're crushed, he will find you if you try. If you have a little trust. If you have a little want to. And you have a little humility to just ask, will you care? Absolutely. With every breath you have, I care.